Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Pixel 3, Google Home Hub, and a slate. Three new Intel CPUs. Project Unicorn Vomit gets an SSD and a gaming headset that cools your ears. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 487, recorded on October 11th, 2018. Pixel 3 and three new Intel CPUs. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today for 3 months free with a one-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/twitch. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most affordable, most expensive, most unhinged, most useful. Well, news and reviews of PC hardware. We love mobile. We love laptops. We love phones. We love the Internet of Stuff. I'd use another word, but this is a family podcast. And joining me now is a family kind of guy, Mr. Alan Malventano of PCPer.com. Welcome, Alan.
Hey, you're like putting me on some kind of family man pedestal there.
Yes, I don't know. You are a family man. You and your wife and your cats.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
I'm looking at the stories today, and I feel like there are two kind of big sets of announcements that are going to dominate the show. One of which, oddly enough, is from Google. And Google dropped several things, dropped something else they didn't bother to mention. And, we also have some parts from Intel. Are you excited about the Pixel 3? Are you in the market for a phone? Are you comfortable with your phone lifestyle at this point?
I mean, I'm like, what, two generations ago now on an iPhone? I got an 8. Like, I'm happy, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a phone. It does phone things. I'm okay. It takes pictures when I need to. Pixel 3 looks cool, though. They seem to be borrowing some design aesthetics from that I'm familiar with from seeing like a year ago, you know, like with the whole notch in the top there and stuff.
It's been funny to watch people react like, you know, well, this notch has a point, not like that other notch. I'm just like, oh, goodness.
I guess.
It's a big notch, though.
It's got the Google Assistant looks good, right?
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. The cameras, the cameras, I think, are probably, as always, kind of the big, I guess, the big push, the big point, kind of the most exciting thing in terms of changes. Not that there's anything. I find it difficult to get super excited about specs on phones at this point in terms of the processor, simply because everything's so fast. Like, you have to have some pretty challenging apps, you know, to challenge it. Snapdragon, 835, 845. Like, this is Snapdragon 845, 4 gigabytes of RAM. Clearly white, just black, not pink. Shannon's really excited because it has stereo, or I should say dual front-firing stereo speakers, which is invariably one of the things that drives her nuts, because most of the speakers on most phones are so atrocious. Bluetooth 5.0. The active edge sensors, which, if I understand correctly, you can sort of squeeze the phone to bring up Google Assistant, which I find slightly terrifying. A wireless charging stand, if you're into that. And, it's interesting to look at these kind of side by side, because if you go into the tech specs on the Google Pixel 3 website, they have sort of the Pixel 2, and the Pixel 3. And the design aesthetic hasn't particularly changed a lot. They've just sort of cleaned it up. But, It's interesting to sort of, they still have the button in the back, the camera notch is pretty interesting on the XL. I don't know how I feel about that. I'll be very curious to see that when Shannon gets hers in. The camera, as always, like I was starting to say before, certainly seems to be a big part of what they've done, but a lot of it seems very incremental to me. Nothing super huge in terms of, there's nothing at this that makes me go, ZOMG, this changes everything, which is not exactly, I think, where we are at with most phones at this point.
I mean, it, it's okay. It's okay to be incremental. You don't always have to be groundbreaking. You just, you know, then you'll, whoever the people are that need a new phone at this moment in time, right, they'll just get the Pixel 3 instead of the Pixel 2, right? You know, slightly newer hardware, slightly better specs.
Right.
A notch they may or may not like. Who knows?
You know, machine learning software that's supposed to... Oop, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's... yeah, there's the AR stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm guessing is what the second front camera helps with.
Yeah.
Do AR with, like, selfies.
It's funny. One of the complaints I've read from a lot of the early responses is that it's only got 4 gigabytes of RAM, and a lot of the flagships have 6 gigabytes. There's some definite concern about the battery size on this. The new OLED screen is pretty spectacular by all counts of everybody who's seen it up close. And, you know, I mean, they're looking to kind of keep their lead in terms of having the best or one of the best cameras out there. And the other thing is that their idea is that they're going to be doing sort of more at the back end. You know, it's a 12.2 megapixel camera, two front facing 8 megapixel camera. There's actually a second selfie camera, which is part of why they have the notch on the XL, because they have two cameras that are facing you, set up, the second camera set up for wide angle selfies. You know, I'll be very curious to hear Shannon's response. She's going to go side by side between the Pixel 3 XL and the Pixel 2 XL. And she's extremely obsessed with the cameras, which I think is kind of a good thing. Still no headphone jack. It's gone.
Yep.
Not
coming back.
Boy Genius Report had a particularly cruel title Chris Smith wrote up at BGR.com. Quote, the Pixel 3 won't help the fact that Google just can't seem to sell Pixel phones, which I thought was harsh. Oof, Samsung's kind of trolling them. Samsung's certainly trolling Pixel over the notch, or Google over the notch in the Pixel. You know, this is...
And then in another year or two, you'll see a notch on a Samsung phone, I'm sure.
You know. I'm curious. I'm curious.
Yeah.
Google Home Hub. You know, we've seen a bunch of devices out there. Lenovo came out with one, particularly nice looking 10-inch screen. They also have an 8-inch version of that. This is the sort of the similar version of it from Home, and you know, so. Like a lot of the Google products, it'll do voice match. So, you know, if I, you know, say good morning, it's different, like different response. Say if my wife says good morning, you know, you can, hey, Google, good night. Like I love the, some of the automation that they're doing on there. You know,
is it able to link with like, so say, you know, we recognize you and your wife separately. Does that mean like if she sets an appointment or something, it goes on her calendar, not yours?
Like, that's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, okay.
Deep integration with Nest. Cool. You know, the idea that you're going to be able to sort of see everything that's going on in your house and get a summary of that on the page. Google Assistant, obviously. The
like a photo frame.
Yeah, cool. You know, $149. The pricing is pretty good. I'll be curious to hear what it sounds like because, you know, I am an audio geek. But... you know, I love the, you know, the thing that we keep seeing from all of these is like, it'll give you, you know, super awesome answers with visual compliments.
When you
ask it for a recipe, which always makes me think of like, you know, people trying to Radio Shack, trying to sell trash 80s back in the 80s, TRS 80s, you know, 1,000 years ago where mom could organize her recipes. Like, that, you know, now it's not mom can organize the recipes, but you can be like, hey, I need a recipe for this. In a YouTube videos on there, which I think they mostly are making a big deal out of just to poke, poke at a certain Amazon.
And then they're throwing in 6 months of YouTube premium when you buy it.
Yeah. They're doing like, 6 months of free music on the Pixel 3, 6 months of YouTube preview on the Google Home HUD. Pixel Slate looks interesting. It's their first tablet in a long time. It is not inexpensive.
That's true.
So I want to say it starts at like, yeah. Well, it starts at $600, and then as you start adding things on, it gets more and more expensive. That $600 version is 4 gigabytes of RAM, 32 gigabytes of storage, or 8 gigabytes of RAM. And well, basically the entry level is $599 for a Celeron processor, 4 gigs of RAM, 32 gigs of storage. You know, by the time you step up to something like a Core i5 or a Core i7, you're looking at $1,000 to $1,600 with 8 or 16 gigabytes of RAM.
Yeah, so, the keyboard's $200. Mm-hmm. That's pretty steep.
Yeah, so, you know, a $600, if you want a keyboard, a $600 tablet becomes an $800 tablet. You know, the $1,000 becomes a $1,200. 12.3-inch display, power button and fingerprint sensor integrated. It looks pretty clean. It's like 7 millimeters thin. Huge number of almost too many. They've got like a different processor, RAM, storage combination at like every price point, which I guess is kind of obvious. I'm curious to see how this goes over. I'm also curious to see what the performance is like on that entry level model. I do love, Chrome OS. You know, in terms of like office or managing students, Chrome OS is fantastic because it's fairly secure and they do a pretty good job of keeping it updated, despite the best efforts of some users. But, I wish the keyboard wasn't so expensive. So
yeah, it just seems really steep even compared to pretty much anything else I can think of. $200 for a tablet keyboard is definitely up there. What else did they launch? Well, they updated, right?
Yeah, the Chromecast.
Yep.
It's funny. There's a particularly brutal Sasha Sagan, PC Mag, runs sort of the mobile department of PC Mag, and he was over at the event, I'm sure, for the Pixel 3. I put this into sort of the harsh but fair category. Quote, Google didn't talk about the new Chromecast at its Pixel event because it's a failed idea. The company needs a new TV approach stat, which should maybe include a Roku acquisition. And it was funny because I was looking for information on this. And you can buy one right now at Best Buy, but you can't actually find much in the way of information on the website. They didn't really talk about it in the announcement. But the big change, they're talking about a 15% boost in performance, kind of a cleaner design, just a simple hockey puck with a letter on it, the letter G on it. 60 frame per second video at 1080p, which is a step up from 720p on the previous generation. And they're bringing in, later this year, after a driver update, they're going to give you the ability to whole house audio or basically make it behave like a Chromecast audio and play the same music as other speakers inside of there. $35, you still stream app by app. The Ultra is going to be around because this one doesn't do 4K and it's going to sell for $35. I'd get one in I'd buy one to review it, but I'm not sure what the point is because it's either going to do 1080p 60 video or it's not. It's funny. I like one of the things that Sasha says in his essay, his opinion piece, is that the idea of controlling your television with your phone is kind of a failed idea. And that people want simple things like remote controls that work, which would bring me to the latest version of the Kavo, which I'm actually doing a review on an AVXL this week, which takes away one of my favorite features from the $400 Kavo, but it also costs $100 and works, functions somewhat more better, to say the least. Did you guys talk about Intel's... the ninth generation processors, like on the podcast yesterday.
Yeah. We covered actually a whole slew of things that were announced. Review embargoes are not up yet on them, so we're still taking a look at stuff here, testing away. Actually, I think there's some testing going on over my shoulder to the right here. Not really a surprise on these particular CPUs because we've kept hearing like tidbits here and there on them, but now they're officially announced. i9-9900K and the i7-9700K. So both of them are 8-core parts. The i9 series, now you have an i9 that's going to be a desktop part, right?
Right.
And prices are a little bit steep, right? You put, you know, it's going to be, actually the prices are being gouged right now on like pre-orders. You're talking like upwards of $600 pre-orders for that part, but supposed to be closer probably to 500, once things stable out. But 8-core, 16-thread part, supposed to boost up to 5 gigahertz. So it's supposed to do, you know, that was like the i7-8086, like that limited edition part was supposed to be like, ooh, fancy, you know, 5 gigahertz part, which it was hit or miss, right? Like some reviewers, when they tested that part, were not able to hit 5. So we're hoping right. that this part actually will, without having to specifically overclock it. Things should be a little bit better, though, because they shifted to a, I'm not sure if you already went past that picture, but they shifted to a soldered thermal interface. In other words, instead of there being thermal paste underneath the heat spreader, there's an actual, like they actually solder it to the processor die, which helps with heat transfer because it's just a more solid interface. You know, and just straight metal tends to conduct heat a little bit better than the thermal paste that they happen to stick under there. Like there was just a whole swath of folks, like a wave of people suddenly interested in delitting their CPU because, you know, you ended up giving up a few degrees just to the interface right. to even get to your heatsink, right? So it should be interesting. There's also some something I'm very interested in, just from my background, is that there is some improvements to the mitigations of Spectre and Meltdown with these parts.
Really?
So, yeah. We don't know, like, how it plays out in real, like real testing and real world applications just yet. But,
right.
You know, they're not all mitigated in hardware, but the different variants of Spectre and Meltdown, you know, some of those variants are, in hardware. But again, what that means exactly for like performance, does it completely make it as if there was never a performance hit in the first place? Probably not.
Right.
But I would imagine that it helps compared to, you know, the situation we were in before, which is once those patches came out and people were seeing some performance hits on specific types of applications. You know, we'll have more info on that when the reviews go up. There was some other stuff on the site recently related to that.
Well, the Z390, which is, I guess, yeah. you know. I mean, it's like a 370 with support for up to 6, I want to say, USB 3.1 Gen 2 ports. That's 10 gigabits per second. And they're building an 802.11ac wireless.
Yeah. So the 802.11ac wireless, even though it's there, it's like optional. Like it doesn't have to be a thing that's enabled by, you know, depending on whether or not that board maker wanted to make that a feature of that particular motherboard, right? So chipsets capable of it doesn't mean that it's always there no matter what. USB 3.1 Gen 2 is probably going to be used by everybody, which is good, right? And I was actually, we were kind of chuckling about it during the podcast because if you scroll way down to like where the backplate is on that, I initially was wondering, well, which one of those three different USB 3.1 labeled ports is actually Gen 2? Well, as it turns out, they all are. So, if you see a red port or a Type-C port on a 390 board, chances are it's just going to be, you know, Gen 2. And that's the difference for people wondering is it's capable of 10 gigabits instead of 5 gigabits. So you're doubling your throughput again. On something that was already, you know, reasonably fast, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think a serial ATA is 6 gigabit. You know, USB 3.1 Gen 1 was 5 gigabit, pretty close to that speed of a good SATA SSD. And now you're doubling that. So that's good.
I'm just trying not to make red shirt jokes.
Yeah. There's a bunch of red ports.
The red ports do we have? Dies.
Oh, yes. Next up is sort of an interesting thing. How about a 28-core Xeon in a workstation machine?
I see no issues with this, except for the price.
Well, yeah. Remember that demo that Intel had the crazy cooling on the 28 core part that they were going to talk about, like for workstation use and things like that? Well, this is that actual part, minus the crazy cooling, but not going the same speed, right? Right. This is not going to be like, it's not going to go 5 gigahertz on air or anything crazy like that. Not with all 28 cores, but 4.3 turbo frequency, not bad, right? But they are talking about, if you look at the verbiage underneath the processor details, which I think you passed, 600 megahertz base clock, or that, sorry, the advantage is 600 megahertz on the base clock and another 0.5 gigahertz on Turbo Boost 2.0 clock over the comparable Xeon, like the regular server side Xeon. So that's a pretty big jump over the server part, you know, for a workstation part. Now, as far as like where you can plug this in, I think it's just going to be like one or two motherboards are going to support this guy. One from Asus and I think one from Gigabyte. So it's, you know, it's not exactly, it's going to be, it's like a niche of a niche from the sounds of it. Yeah. And those workstation boards are just going to be like these beastly things. So it's basically like you want a server, but you want it on your desk. You know, get this thing, right? It's gonna be pretty insane. But again, probably not a lot of volume being sold. But it's definitely, you know, as far as flagships go, like it's a pretty good flagship, 28 core, basically 28 core Xeon, just sitting on your desk.
Sitting on your desk, waiting to process.
waiting to probably, unless you're really throwing stuff at it, probably just waiting to process. Yep. So yeah, a bunch of Intel, you know, CPU stuff and small update with the chipset stuff coming up. But again, they're all sort of announcements for the moment. The reviews, I think we have another like week on, you know, before we'll see actual results.
I was, So we talked about the big Bloomberg story. The original story is essentially that positing that Supermicro had China was hacking U.S. businesses by putting chips on Supermicro motherboards. Some interesting responses to that, like people on Twitter quoting at me, well, so-and-so says it may be a fake story. Well, yeah, it may be a fake story. It's also had a lot of – I also realized that the, one of the people who tweeted at me hadn't actually listened to the podcast, just made assumptions based on a tweet around the podcast. But, you know, there was Bloomberg claiming they had new evidence, another source that Yossi Appelbaum, another security expert, basically was like, okay, he had been doing he'd been working for a telecom company and found, found basically more evidence, I want to say in the form of a modified or a non-standard Ethernet port. And it's been interesting because there's been a lot of people like, see China, and there's been a lot of people who are basically saying this is a fake story. How do you know this is legit?
I think what's pushing it in the fake direction is like I don't know what the right way to phrase it is, but the denials from companies that have been like, not Supermicro, but the denials from like Apple and, you know, companies that have worked and had this hardware, supposedly, like the denials are very clear and very like worded in such a way where there's presumably no fear that the story is actually the other way, right? It's like a very categorical, just flat out denial of like no sort of statements, as opposed to there's really no interpretation being left in them.
Right.
I don't know why. It just, you know.
I mean, that was one of the things that kind of fascinated Ryan and I when we were talking last week was, you know, Apple had written out this incredibly detailed kind of, you know, like, this is a, you know, this is not true, hasn't happened, never did. And just the level for, you know, this is the kind of thing that Apple would normally just quietly ignore and, you know, go look at the notch on the phone, leave us alone. But they had gone and just like, it was just a very long detailed response to this. So one of my favorite takes on this, came out of Vice's, motherboard, their technology coverage, the cybersecurity world is debating. WTF is going on with Bloomberg's Chinese microchip stories. Jason Colbert, Joseph Cox, and Lorenzo Franceschi Bicciarai, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing, and I apologize, Lorenzo. Not that I know you well enough to call you Lorenzo, but quote, no one is really sure who to believe after Business Week's bombshell story on an alleged Chinese supply chain attack against Apple, Amazon, and others. Part of what was crazy about that secondary story they brought in, where the security researcher talked about the telecom, is like every telecom, like I want to say like Verizon and AT&T and everybody else immediately did sort of press releases about it. This wasn't us. And it's been kind of crazy to watch the response to this. Supermicro stock tanked. And before anybody's like, oh, this is somebody trying to short Supermicro stock, this, you know, the level of resources it would take to put together a story like this, it's really curious because there seems to be enough sort of just a lot of effort and a lot of people, you know, and you could also argue that, well, they didn't name any names, but that's not exactly unusual in a story of this type. But you know, just the, like Monday, you know, this week,
just where the story was, the magnitude of the impact of the story. Because, you know, case in point, what happened to Supermicro stock as soon as the story went up, right? There's your reason that you're getting quick and detailed statements out of related companies, right? Like, so that's, you know, that makes sense so far. But yeah, it's definitely a standout just how, you know, much of a flat out denial those statements have been. So.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious about where this one ends up, because this is, you know, you don't really see, this is just, I don't know, it's the legs on this story have been kind of crazy. And yeah, here it is. Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile deny being the quote U.S. telecom unquote mentioned in today's Bloomberg story, alleging compromised Supermicro hardware. You know, the.
Yeah. It's, and like, is that the actual chip? Because I don't even know what you accomplish with three pins. Like, where are you putting those? I don't know. I'm just saying. Like,
yeah.
I haven't seen. I want to see more detail about this supposed chip. Right. Like, I think maybe that's what's driving people to go, it's fake. Because like, you need more than just a story about it. If it's a thing that we know is a chip that was like, we want to know what was it doing to those things.
Right. Like,
you know. Yeah. Like, that's a generalized, like, pictogram style, you know, here's how the chip was put into things, right? Like, I want to see some pictures of the actual hardware. And like, you know, here's the chip. Like, here's what it was connected to. That sort of thing. I think that's what would help solidify it, you know, or at least back it up.
Yeah.
For me, right? Like, so there's, yeah, there's like, oh, it has six pins. Okay.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. Krebs on Security. Well, you know, I thought it was interesting. Like, Krebs on Security did a pretty big response. He's one of my favorite security writers. You know, he says, quote, I heard similar allegations earlier this year about Supermicro and tried mightily to verify them, but could not. That in itself should be zero gauge of the story's potential merit. After all, I am just one guy, whereas this is the type of scoop that usually takes entire portions of a newsroom to research, report, and vet. By Bloomberg's own account, the story took more than a year to report and write, and cites 17 anonymous sources as confirming the activity, unquote. So that's, you know, and one of the things that Krebs points out is you know, the U.S. government has, you know, there's an unofficial, the brown list or the black list, the entity list, but basically companies that are, and I quote, on the permanent stuff list of Uncle Sam for having been caught pulling some kind of supply chain shenanigans. And there's a whole bunch of tech companies on that list. So, you know, it's, you know, this is,
suspect,
you know, this
I suspect Supermicro is on that list.
Possibly, yeah, but you know, but part of the problem is, it, I mean, but part of the issue with this is Supermicro makes a lot of equipment, you know, a lot of specialized motherboards for a lot of companies. And
yeah, that's true.
I don't know. It's we will continue to cover it. There are lots of people that say this is bull stuff. There are lots of people who say this is you know, intense and important. And I have this funny feeling that it's not going to go anywhere. And because it seems like anybody who can or might have evidence on this isn't allowed to talk about it or is afraid of talking about it. So
yeah.
You know, because part of the problem also is that it's you know, vetting hardware is, you know, next to impossible. There's just too much going on that, you know, there's a lot of secondary, you know, there's I don't know. It's a lot of people that are questioning the validity of this. It's an interesting story. Certainly looks to be a fairly intensely researched story. So.
I imagine we'll there will definitely be more to follow on this story.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
We should take a moment to thank our sponsor, ladies and gentlemen. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by ExpressVPN, which I'm using on another computer right over there right now. Now, I use it at home because sometimes I do stuff, and I just don't feel like my ISP knowing exactly what I do. Maybe I'm running something in the background that it feels sensitive. And if you're in a cafe or a hotel, you should be running a VPN. Just to make sure if you're using that public Wi-Fi, that public accessible network, that your comms are a little more secure than they would be otherwise. Doesn't matter if you're in a Starbucks or a hotel. A hacker with the right know-how can just kind of start sucking down packets and trying to figure out what's going on. To protect, you know, I've been using ExpressVPN since they became a sponsor. Easy-to-use apps. They run in the background of your computer. You turn it on and off with a big virtual button on the app. And the idea is that it's very simple. It secures and anonymizes your internet browsing, encrypts your data, hides your public IP address, basically creates a tunnel. That's what that virtual private network is when we talk about VPNs. It's your own private tunnel inside the internet from your computer to one of ExpressVPN servers. You know, if you're worried about public Wi-Fi, a VPN is going to help make you more secure. ExpressVPN was rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar, comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Costs less than $7 a month. If you want a little more privacy, if you want a little more security, a VPN is a good thing to have in your life. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free with a one-year package at expressvpn.com/twitch. That's expressvpn.com/twitch for 3 months free with a one-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/twitch to learn more. Meanwhile, as I continue circling my my sub 250 millimeter GPU for my next build, Gigabyte is advancing the cause of the RTX 2080, the extreme 8G customs graphics card, which will not remotely fit inside of the case that I am building. Turing no. GPU, better power delivery, the Gigabyte's Wind Force Stack 3X cooler. And not one, not two, not five, but seven display outputs on the back of that card. That's yep. a lot of display outputs.
One of them is that VR-specific output, I think.
Right. The virtual link.
Yeah.
USB yeah, Type-C connection. Yeah, three display port, three HDMI, and you can use up to four display ports or HDMI outputs along with the virtual link output simultaneously. I like the fact that there's LEDs in the power connectors that give you state and error codes, RGB LEDs around the fans, and the Aorus logo with 12 preset lighting patterns. We don't have clock speed information for the TU104 GPU, 8 gigabytes of memory, 250. It's basically, you know, it's a 2080, but better.
Yep.
Do we have
and way thicker? Like that's basically three yeah. sets.
You know, also will not fit in the case I'm building. Pricing information I don't think is available either, but I feel like it's going to be spendy.
I mean, it's probably like 50 or 100 over NVIDIA's price, like their mm-hmm. price of the reference card. But granted, that price is kind of high too. I think it's, what, 800 for those?
Mm-hmm.
For the 2080s. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're definitely up there. And I don't see them coming down anytime soon, unfortunately.
Well, you know, they got some inventory to clear out. Something I didn't expect either. Threadripper 2790WX and 2920X availability with a new dynamic local mode feature. It's basically more second generation Threadripper CPUs, 12 and 24 core variants. Kind of the two big ones were the 2990WX, that's 32 core, 64 thread Threadripper. But basically now they've got 3264, 2448, 1632, and 1224, i.e. Two steps in between, one step below the 2950X and one yep. step above the 2950X.
Interesting is if you're trying to use your granted these are meant for like workstation machines, but the idea is you can do other stuff. You don't have to do nothing but workstation things. Maybe you want to fire up a game on your workstation. Maybe you want to use an application that's not necessarily like a workstation-y kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There were some disadvantages to this particular architecture. Actually, if you look at that block diagram, although it's a little bit confusing, the idea is that there were four dies within the package of the CPU, and only two of those dies were connected to memory. And your PCI devices as well. So basically that meant that half of the cores within this whole Ryzen, you know, CPU as a whole, half of the cores had some form of a direct connection to the system resources, while the other half of the cores had to go over the fabric, no matter what, mm-hmm. to do those communications. So ideally, if you had like, a choice of where would you want these threads to run, chances are you'd want to stick with the ones that had their own, you know, memory directly connected to them and whatnot.
Right.
So the catch was, this is kind of like too many layers deep, probably, on what at least the window scheduler is designed to handle. Like you can handle, you know, UMA and NUMA, and that this memory is connected to this CPU over here, and this other bank of memory is connected to this other, you know, CPU over here, and there's different layers to how the scheduler can like prioritize things. But once you start getting to the point where like, well, half of the cores are not connected to any memory. Well, now it's like, you know, they probably have to add this in as yet another layer to how the scheduler is programmed, in the Windows kernel. I think Linux already has some, you know, concessions or provisions for this kind of a layout already, and can work around it. Windows mm-hmm. takes longer than Linux, obviously, to, you know, to do those kinds of kernel level updates. But AMD has kind of a workaround, which is this thing called a dynamic local mode. So it is basically a piece of software that runs. It's part of the software suite, I think, or at least they're adding it. But what it does is it just kind of like observes what threads are running and on what cores they are running on in the system. And it most likely it just does it by kind of like manually setting affinity at the thread level, which you can do in Windows. It's just, it helps if you have a program doing it for you. So this kind of like attempts to do a little bit of micromanaging on what threads or which cores the threads are being moved to or running on in the first place. So if you do something like that on a processor like this, and you know, less likely that a thread will get stuck on a core that doesn't have its own memory connected directly to it, you can get some performance boost out of that. You know, makes sense. And the end result is probably bringing it more in line with a processor that didn't have, you know, that disadvantage to it, right? Like this right. is sort of a catch. Like you're basically running an EPYC processor in a desktop. So there has to be some concessions made, and those concessions are that, well, you don't get to connect RAM to all four dies. You have to, you know, only connect it to two, right? Which puts you at a little bit of a disadvantage compared to just, you know, standard Ryzen kind of CPU that didn't have that kind of a segmentation, right? So good on AMD for for coming up with that sort of a solution, or at least an attempt of a solution to the problem. And it might end up being something, I don't know if the whole suite will be, but maybe like just some subset of this, just the part that does the dynamic local mode thing. Maybe that'll eventually just ship as like a part of Windows, right? Because you already have, I think the Intel tool is either built in or it downloads on its own as part of like a driver pull for like, I forget the name of the Intel tool, but there's the one that does the, you know, most favorite core, right? For like overclocking. Right. And, is able to kind of like, you have to do something at the OS level to like kind of translate that and communicate that and make sure that the threads in the OS or favoring one particular core that happens to be the fastest one. Same kind of thing can apply for AMD. It just has to eventually, hopefully just work its way into Windows so you don't have to install an extra thing once you've installed your OS for the first time. Or, if it's just part of the AMD suite, chances are people are installing that anyway because it has a bunch of other overclocking features and, other things that people are probably wanting to use anyway if you're on AMD.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense.
Cool stuff. Yep.
Speaking of cool stuff. Yep. No, I'm laughing because I was about to jump ahead to what may be the most ridiculous headset we've heard of in a long time. But let's talk about the HyperX RGB. If you can't make your flash faster, if you can't make your flash faster, you can make your fast flashier. Which I could have sworn was all you, but that was actually Jeremy Hellstrom. Essentially, Project Unicorn Vomit has an SSD option. Project Unicorn Vomit being my affectionate name for the all, just basically the idea of how many LEDs can we pack inside of a single suffering case. But RGB to the HyperX Fury SSD lines. Any thoughts on this? Performance-wise,
so
versus
LEDs?
I mean,
it's a good SATA SSD. Just happens to have RGB LEDs built into it. And a 4-pin, I think it's a 4-pin header built into it. So you can attach it to, an extra cable gets attached to the SSD and then gets attached to, if your motherboard has pin header outs for driving, RGB LED strips or whatnot. You can just plug it into this instead and control that from your motherboard or from anything that can drive, the 4-pin type RGB LED strips. We have one. I'm testing it. I don't know that the Team Group one actually had it was multiple channels. I want to say it was maybe 8 channels worth across the front of it. So you can actually have if you had a cycling pattern or something, it would actually roll across the front of the SSD. I imagine the Kingston ones, the HyperX ones, probably similar. If you want the SSD to look cool, and you're into the RGB thing, it works. And I haven't seen the Team Group one actually impressed me. It performed reasonably well for a SATA SSD. And I was kind of expecting it to be gimmicky just because it had RGBs on it and was it'll probably just be a joke as far as performance goes. No, this is good, solid performing SATA SSD. I would be shocked if the HyperX brand launched a subpar SATA SSD at this point, given all their previous releases. So, I just took a good SSD and add some RGBs to it, light the thing up.
HyperX make a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I like the look of it. It's cool what they did with the, with the cutout there and how it lights up.
It's nice when you have bling that doesn't necessarily compromise the performance of the device you're building. So I'm just saying.
I'm okay with blinging it out as long as it doesn't make it worse. that's my threshold, right? As long as it's still Shannon, good performance.
I can tell Shannon she can go ahead and buy the fantastic RGB encrusted, inladen, packed. Man, 960 gigabytes, $234.99. 1 terabyte SSDs are kind of cheap right now.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Especially SATA.
G-Skill, by the way.
Yeah. So this G-Skill memory, there is RGBs on it.
Right.
But don't let that throw you. this is actually doing something else that's pretty interesting. So the idea is, say you wanted to make a small form factor motherboard that only had a couple of DIMM slots on it, right? Right. But you wanted to be able to put the capacity, the amount of memory installed into this board, you'd want to do something that would previously have been limited to a memory kit that would require 4 DIMM slots, right?
Sure.
So you're trying to fit 4 DIMM slots worth of memory into 2 DIMM slots. How do you do that? Well, most like the Intel platforms is dual channel memory controller, meaning there's 2 memory channels, there's 2 sets of address and data buses. They might be split between a pair of physical slots for each channel, giving you 4 slots total. You could just kind of rearrange like how the electrical connections are done. And you can, if you kind of cram twice as much memory onto a given DIMM, and you were creative with how you wired a couple of the pins, and if the motherboard was aware of it, which it has to be for this to work, you could basically make 4 DIMM slots worth of memory fit into 2. You just have to kind of modify the spec a little bit to kind of work around a couple of logical things that have to change. And that's what's going on here. So the idea is you have a 2 DIMM kit, and you can get 64 gig into a system with only 2 DIMMs.
Nice.
Clocked at a decent speed. So this is up to like 3.2 gigahertz. The timings look decent. It's just, there's no real trickery. It's just they're kind of... I don't know if JEDEC is going to turn this into an actual spec. I'd imagine they probably will at some point. But they're kind of like, just taking a step ahead of the game here. So just realize if you pick this memory up, there is a limited number of motherboard support is required. The stuff will not work, or I'd imagine if you plugged it in anyway, you'd probably only see half of the memory that was available. Which would be kind of a waste of money given RAM prices currently. So, yeah, if you have a need to fit an insane amount of memory into a small form factor system that only has 2 slots, there is now a way to do it, and it only works with a few of the Z390 boards, specifically from Asus. We haven't heard anybody else doing it yet, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Asus for the boards, and then G-Skill for the memory, very specific subset of parts. It's almost like that 28-core Xeon workstation CPU that only works with one, maybe two motherboards, right? Same kind of thing.
Well, it's nice to not have to sort through the 34, individual motherboard options from each of 6 manufacturers.
Also true. Yes, it would be nice to go on Newegg or something and sort by specific thing and then only get 2 results. As you only get to pick one or the other. Yes.
Oh my goodness. Somebody, I should have pointed out that HyperX Fury RGB SSD, is actually kind of spendy for a 1 terabyte. At $220, for a 1 terabyte or just under 1 terabyte SATA 3 SSD. That compares to a Crucial MX500 at $160 or a Samsung 860 Evo for $167. So a Western Digital Blue 3D NAND 1 terabyte PC SSD for $150. You are paying not quite a 50%, maybe a 40% VIG for those LEDs on the HyperX Fury.
They're going for, I think, a little bit more of a premium kind of thing. Just look at the build of the thing, right? They're going super fancy on it. So that's, it's meant to be more of a showy thing. The person probably willing to throw in an extra $50 to let their SSD have glowy bits, I guess. The team group,
I guess.
the team group RGB SSD, like, it wasn't as spendy. Probably similar performance. It was, you know, decent performing SSD. But yeah, I mean, the HyperX, you know, you're partially paying for the name. You're paying a little bit of a premium because you're going to put that in a system with HyperX keyboard, mouse, headset, you know, all synchronized in unison color as they're cycling through their colors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should, I want to give a shout out on this one. I found out about this a few weeks ago and the reviews are just starting to come out. I've been looking at a fairly high-end headset that I'm a little disappointed with. But at the same time, somebody's like, have you heard that HP is doing a cooling headset? And it's the Omen Mindframe. Windows Central did a review. The Verge did a review. And essentially, they put thermoelectric coolers or Peltier coolers in these so that they literally cool off the inside of the ear cup. And, okay, that's cool. You know, it's... It's cool. I mean, it's cool.
Yeah. You know, ice boxes. Then you get to the price
for your ears. Yeah, the price is like $200, and something that I've run into with several headsets. You know, there's a couple issues, right? There's no volume control for the mic on these. You can only adjust the level on the headphones. You know, they. You know, there's an off, high, medium, and low settings for it that you run off of the control software. The Verge points out two things. One, you can't turn off the 7.1 virtual sound off ever, which I think is a big no-no for a gaming headset because a lot of games do not do well with the 7.1 artificial 7.1 or synthetic 7.1 surround sound. And number two, yeah. You know, it's the general consensus is that the audio is pretty miserable, you know, possibly because of the, you know, inclusion of the refrigerators, the cooling plates in there, you know, the, you know, it's the mic's not bad, but you get a giant beep, when you put the mic in the mute position, which is really irritating. You know, the sound performance is, you know, I like, you know, I like how kind of specific, Stephen Etienne got on The Verge where he's basically just, you know, you can get better audio for a lot less money. But it's unfortunate because it's one of the things we keep running into in gaming headsets over and over again, where they've done a lot of interesting things, but they haven't really bothered to, you know, do a good job on the audio. And another thing I've kind of noticed, for example, the WindowsCentral.com has some issues with the audio, but they still say the audio quality is above average. And for me, what's really frustrating is realizing that a lot of the people who are like, this sounds amazing, have never actually heard their regular gaming sound through, you know, even an inexpensive but quality set of headphones. If you do have hot, sweaty ears, and cooling off your ears is a massive priority or would make your life a lot better, keep an eye out for the HP Open Mindframe. And it's kind of painful $200 price. The other thing that amused me is Hard OCP reminded me, the announcement kind of came out of nowhere in the middle of September. And I feel like we didn't talk about this, but I want to make sure we did. Whirlwind FX is the company.
Yeah.
Vortex is the device. And I love this description. And, you know, I like my words. The world's first environmental simulator for PC gaming. PC peripheral instantly adds immersion and intensity to any game or multimedia experience. And so the idea is that there's an air deflector.
This is like just straight up ripping off, what is it, the Magnavox commercial?
Memorex. Is it live or is it Memorex?
Is it live? Yeah, like that's just funny. Like they went exactly for it there. They weren't even holding back.
Yeah. I mean, this was announced back at CES 2018. I want to say, you know, it's $120. The reviews on it have been kind of amusing. Quote,
you know, it's adding some sensory stuff.
Yeah, which is nothing wrong with that. Quote, when it correctly identifies the environment, the vortex delivers an incredible layer of realism. In Battlefield, I felt the heat from a burning tank and gusts of air as vehicles passed. Similarly, the vortex responded to the opening mountain climbing scene in Rise of the Tomb Raider as though it were made for it, delivering bursts of air whenever the on-screen wind picked up. However, there was still a disconnect since the cool air isn't as intense as a snowy chill or even a refrigerator. Meanwhile, the heat can be intense, but not uncomfortably so. The device was less impressive with Shadow of the Tomb Raider. The vortex seemed to be confused by the underwater sequences, firing puffs of warm air while Lara was swimming. It also intermittently delivered puffs of warm air.
Swimming doesn't blow hot air in your face.
No, and apparently it sort of randomly puffs warm air even when there's nothing going on in a lot of games. So,
I mean, maybe handy in the winter, you know.
It's an interesting concept. You know, one of the things is apparently as it kind of warms up over time, it becomes less. It becomes less capable of delivering cool air. I'm tempted to get one into review just because it's so odd. And then I realized I kind of had to figure out like which one, what game I would actually test it with. Cause you know, Rocket League, I'm not exactly, hurting for warm puffs of air in my face. So I'll find something to test it with, but, $120, USB connection. It's out there. If you're looking for a more immersive gaming environment. So you guys are basically testing a whole bunch of new Intel processors. Ryan's on his way back from somewhere, somehow.
Yep.
Anything you can tease that's going on at PC Per?
I mean, it's, you know, just expect some of that Intel content soon. I mean, that's the bee's knees right now. That's the big stuff coming up.
Oh my goodness. We had a lot of fun.
Ken has been rapidly lapping the office behind, like around in front of me. He keeps like running back and forth, just testing various things. There's sparks flying testing all like over the place.
Wind. Oh yes, my goodness.
Test like the wind.
Don't burn the lab down while Ryan's not there. That's okay. Oh my goodness. We had a viewer that was actually looking for the best television, but they didn't want anything bigger than 43 inches, which is kind of fun because you never get people asking for smaller televisions. And I will say, if you can fit a 55-inch television over a 43-inch television, do it. Shannon took a look at Acer's Predator Helios 300 Special Edition gaming laptop, which has gold. And then we had an extended conversation with my friend Will Smith. He does Foo VR. He used to run Tested. He is deeply involved in the VR lifestyle. He basically creates VR content for a living. And we talked about the Oculus Quest and how it compares to the Go and the Rift and the HTC Vive. And if you should be, you know, kind of like when you should make the decision to wait for a Quest versus buying a Rift or a Go now. So if you've been thinking about VR for this holiday season, it's definitely worth taking a look at that one. That's TechThing 198 up at techthing.com. And later on today, I'll be recording my latest AV Excel with Robert Herron, where we'll talk about televisions and speakers and home theater. And there's a little bit of news that came out of Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, but mostly I just wish I'd heard some of the insane $75,000 speakers that are on display at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, because I find things like that amusing, especially when I can find a $500 speaker that sounds almost as good. It's a life goal, people. Oh my goodness. Twit.tv/TWICH is the place to find all of our older episodes, links on how to subscribe, the RSS feed. I highly recommend, if you haven't been to twit.tv/Twitch, head on over there. You'll find some fine technical podcasting, especially if you're looking for hardware news. You can find Mr. Alan Malventano, a.k.a. at Malventano, over at PCPer.com. You can find me at Patrick Norton on the Twitters, or at, of course, I mentioned that tech thing, or AVXL. And we want to thank each and every one of you for listening to the podcast and being a part of it. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Alan Malventano.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.